We want information. Information. Information.
Who are you?
The new number two.
Who is number one?
You are number six.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
Of truth. I'm Gordon Comstock, and we're continuing on today providing audiobooks for you, which you will never ever find in a public library, because these would be considered subversive to the oligarch's system. So anyway, the book that we're in the middle of right now is the unpublished manuscript from 1990, from the late Maureen Heaton, entitled The Impossible Dream. She's referring to the oligarch's impossible dream of a new world order. Well, they're going to take a good shot at it. Get it for a while, but Jesus Christ is going to come back and drop some elbows and end all that pretty quickly. But there's going to be some real hell on earth before that. Anyway, what's interesting about this book so far, if I could put in a little review of it, a little comment, what I notice is you find a lot of books which deal with the Illuminati, New World Order, call it what you will, whoever you want to call the establishment, the oligarchs, whatever. You find a lot of books which deal with these people, these elitists. A lot of books deal with it from a big picture point of view, from a top-down point of view. This is really a different view. This Maureen Heaton is looking at the encroachments of the Illuminati / New World Order / whatever. She's looking at their tentacles from a local point of view, as they affect the local life, as they disintegrate cities and counties and turn them into regions, or Soviets, if you will. So Maureen Heaton, this is cool. She really looks at this from a different angle than most books I've encountered on this subject. So, with all that said, this is chapter 31 of The Impossible Dream by Maureen Heaton, and we'll get to as many chapters as we can in the next 45-50 minutes. So chapter 31, Time Bombs. Hidden away in the California Constitution, 21st in a series of 25 articles on a variety of subjects, is a time bomb approved by the people of that state 60 years ago. What illusion was created to obtain passage of that section is lost in the mist of time. But all this while, it has lain dormant, unused until 1966, when the legislature lit the fuse by passing enabling legislation. Not that the 1966 legislators necessarily knew that they were lighting a fuse when they passed the bills which activated the bomb. Unless they had done a great deal of homework, they likely wouldn't know. And what legislators do their own research these days, with all those aides and consultants to do it for them? If they had, however, they would have found in Section 21 of Article 25, the constitutional quote-unquote authority for that legislation, and they might not have approved it. They might even have taken that section back to the people for corrective action. The section begins, quote, "The legislator is hereby expressly vested with plenary power, unlimited by any provisions of this Constitution, to create and enforce a complete system of workers' compensation," unquote. The phrase, quote, "unlimited by any provisions of this Constitution," unquote, is the time bomb. In 1970, the State Constitution Revision Commission, or CRC, considered revising this section, but by a, quote, "narrowly divided vote," unquote, restrained themselves. Those learned citizens recognized what it would mean to have so vital a matter brought up in debate before the people. They noted that any change, quote, "would disturb the workmen's comp system," unquote, and that, quote, unquote, obviously, the words didn't mean what they appeared to say, since, quote, "no one would think that it intended to eliminate the provisions of the Constitution with respect to equality before the law or with making gifts of public money," unquote. And the State Constitution Revision Commission quietly passed over Section 21. Very interesting, the sections the commission chose to cite as being beyond believing that anyone would intend to negate them. Quote, "Equality before the law," unquote, was what the court found existed in the oppressive rulings of the Tahoe Regional Agency since, the court said, the same treatment would hold in any other regional area. Any credibility that disbelief expressed by the CRC was made moot by the legislative action which had resulted in 1966 from this unlimited delegation of plenary power given the stamp of approval by hands long gone before the damage they permitted was done. In that law, an appointed board is given, quote, "full power, authority, and jurisdiction with all the requisite governmental functions," unquote, over all workmen's compensation disputes. But the CRC only looked at the Constitution, not the enabling legislation. And so, a large group of American citizens lost the protections of the Bill of Rights. Right of redress, ostensibly protected by both state and federal constitutions, is effectively denied to any citizen of average means who gets caught up in this nightmare of non-justice. One man determines first jurisdiction. One man becomes judge and jury. One man determines the decision. One man makes the award. One man decides the amount, and that same. One man is empowered to enforce his own judgment. He may place liens against everything the victim owns, up to the amount of the award. The victim may not turn to the real courts and a jury of his peers, nor even challenge jurisdiction, without posting a bond double the amount found against him. An impossibility for the average citizen, when the amount of the award can be equal to all his assets. Despite the comforting determination of the Revision Commission, the unlimited plenary power delegated in this section of the California Constitution shatters the carefully provided protection from government each citizen is entitled to have. But that is a time bomb in only one state. How many other states have such provisions lying dormant, waiting for the fuse to be lit? Have you studied your state constitution? Can you be sure there is no such provision waiting to destroy your security? Those who would deny the, quote, conspiracy theory, unquote, of planned destruction of our government would do well to study this matter carefully. Look at your own state constitutions and then check the amendments to the federal constitution which have followed the Bill of Rights. The federal constitution is a grant of powers from the people and the states. I don't know about that. The Bill of Rights placed restrictions on those powers. Maureen. Both applied to the federal government only. 9 of the 16 amendments which were passed after adoption of the Bill of Rights grant additional power to Congress, i.e. the federal government. These are federal time bombs which have been detonating regularly. Small explosions mainly, but some of great magnitude, all traceable to these additional grants of power. But all these are minor time bombs compared to the nuclear force embodied in the proposed so-called equal rights, quote-unquote, amendment. Insistently proposed since the 1920s, the Equal Rights Amendment would be precisely that. Equal rights for all citizens to enjoy the, quote, equality before the law, unquote, which the citizens at Tahoe have, and which are available to any citizen of California who runs afoul of the Workmen's Compensation Board. Equal right to have no rights. For the ERA is limited only to those matters where male or female, are involved. And it is in those areas where the Bill of Rights applies. Male or female are all the citizens we have. The Bill of Rights prohibits the federal government from exercising those certain powers against the citizens. Again, Maureen Heaton is a constitutionalist. I used to be, folks. Go to atgpress.com, read the works of James Montgomery or The Informer and several others on there, and they'll show you what I think, what I feel now is the truth, that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, it was all a fraud. It was not designed for you and me, us regular folk. The Founding Fathers sold us out from the beginning. Don't mistake the Christianity of the Pilgrims and the Puritans for the deism and the masonry and the lawyerly secret societies of the Founding Fathers. Anyway, yeah, I know, Maureen, I used to be on board with that. I used to be a constitutionalist. Anyway, back to the book. The ERA has been called a quote-unquote people's amendment because it mandates equality to both sexes. It doesn't define equality, however. Equal tyranny, as at Tahoe? Only color of law was granted in that amendment to the California Constitution of so long ago. Plenary power given to an appointed arbitrator is a travesty. Plenary power is granted by the ERA to the federal government, and it would be exercised by appointed minions. It would nullify not just the rights of the citizens, but of the states as well, because in it, that power is granted to the federal government, bypassing states' rights. The words of a school superintendent in Palos Verdes, California, echo down the years as proponents of quote-unquote equal rights continue to press for passage of their essential revolutionary weapon. His quote, quote, "We shall have another election, and another, until we win," unquote. The revolutionaries dedicate the whole of their lives to their cause. Unless that dedication is met with equal strength, the end is predictable. Watchmen, what of the night? Chapter 32, Post-Constitutional America. As the cybernetic society begins to take visible form, even the man in the street begins to, quote, view with alarm, unquote, the evidence that the body politic is suffering convulsions from some massive internal disorder, an excellent diagnosis of the illness afflicting our society, appeared 20 years ago in the February 1970 issue of Trans Action, a slick elitist magazine. The writer had impeccable credentials as a research assistant at Brookings Institute, that think tank operation. He was a former Randsman. Parentheses, Rand is another think tank, end parentheses. And had other prestigious connections. Alan Schick wrote with confidence about the cybernetic society, as well he might, being in the thick of the inner circle which was even then creating it. His article was frighteningly accurate, as it related the events leading to the cybernetic society. It became even more disturbing as he moved from what was in 1970 to what is 20 years later, especially since he wrote as though the cybernetic society was even then solidly in place. It is regrettable that Mr. Schick was studiously non-critical of the matters he wrote about, for given his evident talents, he could have been an invaluable ally for liberty. As he calmly reported on the sequential incidents which happened to take this nation on the path it followed, the impression was created that C followed B, which followed A, as morning follows night, which follows evening. One is left with the feeling that it was an inexorable progression, following a natural course, not subject to alteration or intervention. Terming the government provided in our Constitution a, quote, political state, unquote, Schick posited that the so-called Industrial Revolution and the growth of huge corporate conglomerates led to unrestrained regulation by government and to the emergence of the, quote, administrative state, unquote. There is no suggestion that the administrative state was, in fact, as the record shows, a planned development. New Deal activities, Schick avers, opened the door to the, quote, bureaucratic state, unquote, which inevitably led to the, quote, cybernetic state, unquote. Again, no recognition of the extensive evidence of a planned program to achieve these, quote, unquote, states. Schick did not question either the legality or the constitutionality of these changes. He simply viewed them as natural phenomena. He pointed out that, before administrative governance, the constitutional rules of representation still applied. But with the emergence of regulatory agencies, advisory boards, and other appointive offices, Congress was, quote-unquote, liberated from representation. For Congress, quote, can no longer exercise close supervision of their action, unquote. Parentheses, Mr. Schick's article was written about the time that the courts were finding that to be a legal principle, unquote. As the only establishment figure, to my knowledge, who admits that the role of the Supreme Court during the time he designated as the, quote, political state, unquote, was in fact interpreter of events relative to the Constitution, it is disappointing to find that Mr. Schick found no fault when the role of the court changed to being a rubber stamp for administrative governance, with no lawful authority for that change, and that he nodded approvingly at the court's increased emphasis on separation of public and private affairs and of administrative and political matters, all without changing the Constitution to permit them. Schick pointed out that the, quote, bureaucratic state, unquote, which followed the administrative phase, began the change from government regulation of business and citizen action to government operation of businesses and control of the citizens. According to Schick, at this point, quote, participatory democracy, unquote, became important, as citizens found they could no longer control the bureaucracy through their elected representatives, who had forfeited their constitutional duties to appointed administrators. Schick describes how bureaucrats used citizen activists to support their demands on Congress and the President, how Congress looked to the citizen groups for approval of what was being done in their name. Parentheses, seen any good opinion polls lately? End parentheses. And the presidency used such groups to mobilize the apathetic voters or to act as go-between for him and the masses. Schick ignores the essential element of representation, which is that government responds to the will of the people. Obtaining consent by such contrived means as group dynamics or Delphi techniques is not what the Constitution is about. Mr. Schick also did not discuss in this area how, once the cybernetic state was in place, participatory democracy would have to be phased out. Neither did he expound on how it could operate to further the march into the cybernetic society on its own initiative, once the people learned how democracy could be used to achieve a goal not shared by the majority of a constituency. Development of crowd control techniques, such as group dynamics, Delphi, sensitivity training, and numerous other variants, opened the door for quote-unquote democracy to perform entirely apart from the official political moves, all the while supporting the official goal. These events also affected the court, where decisions turned from passive examination of impact on the Constitution to active participation in the political process. The court upheld nationalization of human rights, as in civil rights, applying federal standards to an ever-broadening police power in the states, in defiance of the Ninth and Tenth Amendments. As the cybernetic age dawned, Schick pointed out, the court function again changed. From telling the government what it must not do, it began instructing the government in what it must do. Mr. Schick focuses on the fact that the lines between public and private sectors began to diminish as governmental regulation became endemic. Government also began to change from a doer of public acts it became a distributor and withholder of public benefits. Schick noted that, in 1970, cybernetic programs were still embryonic. Government lacked the capability of controlling and monitoring all the factors the system demanded. 20 years later, government has achieved a substantial capability in all elements of cybernetics. As public-private boundaries disappear, a similar disintegration takes place in the political, bureaucratic, and administrative spheres. Administrative action becomes politicized. Political action becomes bureaucratized. As Schick stated, quote, "The supreme political action of determining legislative districts has been turned over to computer specialists," unquote. Parentheses. "We couldn't agree more. We think you will find also that when you read in this book, we think you will also find it so when you read in this book the sad tale of the California experience with, quote unquote, reapportionment," end parentheses. Policy determinations had become dependent on, quote, "the internal dynamics of the political organization," end quote, Schick reported. In making decisions, public officials now rely on reports, past budgets, data, money available, staff experts, and the cybernetic goals, instead of the needs and desires of the citizens. America now, in the last decade of the 20th century, is in the ultimate cybernetic state. Pro forma representation still exists, but the elected officials are listening to a different drummer than that which beats out the song of America. Elections are still held, but they have no meaning. The only real issues are non-issues to today's candidates. The caliber of most of the people who offer for election is such that most of them accept this ersatz means of governance without question. It will take a calculated, strenuous, courageous effort to replace a majority of those now holding office with people who understand these things and are willing to place themselves and their reputations on the line to support, defend, and restore our Constitution and the good life it provided. That is the only way post-constitutional America can be nullified. Chapter 33, Fifth Estate or Fifth Column. He was one of the more obscure establishment persons, and the subject had no apparent pertinence to anything being reported at that time on the news. So the immediate question had to be, quote, "Why was Tom Braden, erstwhile small-town California publisher and editor, long-time supporter of liberals and their causes, vicious anti-conservative, why was he brought into prime national TV news time to discuss what he called the Fifth Estate?" End quote. The fact that this interview took place at all lends more importance to the matters discussed than they might seem to have. The first, quote-unquote, three estates are, of course, the lawful government of the United States, legislative, judicial, executive. To those, in time, was added a, quote-unquote, fourth estate, the press. But now, here was Braden, assisted by NBC's David Hartman, gratuitously pointing out that there is now a fifth estate, the army of nameless, faceless persons who do much of the work for which, quote-unquote, representatives are elected. Was this another attempt to quiet the restless natives, parentheses. Braden made a point of saying that, quote, nothing could be done, unquote, about it, end parentheses. Was the subject somehow tied to the then current, quote unquote, investigations about security? Parentheses. Braden said that it was impossible to provide protection for confidential matters due to the Fifth Estate. End parentheses. His open reference to these two possible reasons for his appearance probably eliminates them as cause for the interview. Past experience has shown that the quote-unquote insiders usually have some oblique motive for the moves they make, and they never, but never, give the true reasons for their moves. Braden spoke of the more than 30,000 secretaries, assistants, and other staff in Washington, D.C. alone, who develop the position papers for elected officials, write their speeches, answer their mail, and otherwise relieve them of the labors of public office. These are duly on the payroll, so, presumably, they are subject to some kind of control. In addition to these, Braden said, there are about 3,000 unpaid, quote-unquote, volunteers, with access to everything in a congressional or senatorial office. These are, quote-unquote, brilliant scholars, college students, or political supporters of the incumbent, identities not necessarily mutually exclusive. These do not have ID cards, nor are they accountable for their background, activities, or intent. While not in any way impugning those among them who have no ulterior motive, parentheses, and there are surely some of those, end parentheses, the dangers involved in the equivalent of a military division of unauthorized volunteers supposedly doing the quote-unquote people's business cannot be overstated. One remembers Beria's psycho-politicians with a cold shiver. These swarms of the unelected abound in the states as well as in Washington. In the light of the record of once staunch Americans who held office and who betrayed the trust given them by their constituents through personal degradation, psychopolitics becomes more believable. One cannot, for instance, imagine John Schmitz, longtime California senator, effective congressman, parentheses, with an unexcelled voting record in both seats, end parentheses, sometime candidate for president, devoted husband and father, loyal friend, devout Catholic, dedicated foe of aberrant sexual behavior, casting off all his lifelong principles and qualities of character on his own initiative, betraying his wife and his 8 children, not to mention the thousands of his supporters, and quote-unquote shacking up with one of his campaign workers. But as a result of psycho-political manipulation, such behavior is precisely what can be expected. When Tom Braden's quote-unquote volunteers are viewed in the context of formal governmental precautions, i.e. resumes, job applications, security checks, closed-circuit TV, and the like, it is passing strange to find that these people have the run of the Capitol office buildings sans accountability. Reference to a speech made in the House at this proximate time, but on a different subject, this army of volunteers could well assume the aspect of a fifth column, rather than Mr. Braden's Fifth Estate. While bringing out such information as Mr. Braden did is an admirable endeavor, It is counterproductive to assert that nothing can be done about it unless that was the goal, to have nothing done. Anything the government is presently doing can be changed if the proper corrective steps are taken. This is not to say that the day may not come when that will no longer be true, unless such steps are begun, and that soon. Over 50 years ago, then Congressman Samuel Pettengill, Democrat, Indiana, put this situation in perspective when he wrote that it begs the question to say that it is hard to tell when twilight ends and night begins. There is a point, he stated, quote, beyond which it is night. There is a point where freedom ends and despotism begins, end quote. Perhaps it would be more applicable here to say that the shadows of despotism foretell the end of freedom. There the simile ends, however, for night must fall, and our government need not. At the heart of the problem, as in so many cases today, is the burgeoning bureaucracy by which decisions formerly made by elected officials become the purview of these appointed experts. The more control put into their hands, the more hands are needed to exercise the control. It is futile to pass laws to close loopholes like this, even when those holes are big enough to drive a herd of buffalo through. Only a solution which includes elimination of the unelected decision makers can correct situations such as this. Chapter 34. The Contratemps in the NSC. The long-awaited moment had arrived. As he strode into the hearing room, his whole mien was one of confidence. He was handsome, erect, assured, a prototype of what a responsible young official in the executive office of the president should be. In his position, he had been one of the select few with access to vital information essential to national security and administration of the affairs of state. In his official capacity, he had the responsibility of helping to formulate policy, and of developing ways and means of carrying those policies forward. Now he was brought before a committee of the Congress to answer to the manner in which he had discharged his duties. A groundswell of support from his colleagues in the executive office, as well as from the general public, grew as he faced his questioners and parried their thrusts with remarkable skill. He was articulate, calm in the face of an evident bias in the interrogation, and support for him intensified as the days of his ordeal passed. His name was Alger Hiss. The parallel of that long-ago hearing to the matter of Oliver North appears to trail off at that point, except that the impact of these two men in the performance of their official duties must continue to affect the course of this nation. There may be yet another parallel. If so, it is exceedingly unlikely that it will ever be officially disclosed, especially as it might apply to Oliver North. If such a parallel as I am about to suggest exists, it would be of such extreme importance that to fail to include it as a possible cybernetic exercise would be a dereliction on my part. It is an established fact that Alger Hiss was under communist discipline all during the time that he was an official in the State Department. Oliver North's testimony about his activity as a member of the group selected to advise his commander-in-chief on national security matters, and the manner in which he presented that testimony strongly suggests that he, too, might have been under discipline. Not quote-unquote communist discipline, to be sure, but a control even more sinister. Thank you, Maureen. Thank you. The guy's a hero now in the Hitler channel. The History Channel. The guy's a drug runner. When the United States Congress passed the National Security Act of 1947, a whole new spectrum of problems was created, problems far more inimical to the security of this country than those NSA 47 was stated to cure. By the way, if you doubt that Oliver North was a drug runner, there are many books you could read on the subject, which I could recommend. One that comes to mind immediately is Compromised by Terry Reed, R-E-E-D. Compromised by Terry Reed. Check it out. See if I'm not right. Back to the book. Among its provisions, NSA 47 reorganized the separate autonomous military departments into one integrated unified command, creating a structure ideally designed to house the ultimate cybernetic servo mechanism. In the debates on the bill, this fact was never mentioned. It was not a consideration because, at that time, only a select few knew that there was a scheme afoot to revolutionize the conduct of the public business. Only that small, select group knew then that the systematic management was the wave of the future. But almost no one else, except those directly involved in creating the system, did. Absence of that information permitted a fatal flaw in the decision Congress made on the National Security Act. For, as a result of NSA 47, the Department of Defense became the incubator for the system of management and control, and a cancerous lesion on the body politic. So what does all this have to do with Oliver North? Simply this. There is a clear record of activity within the ranks of the educational establishment of complicity in development of methods and controlling people, places, and things. In the section of this book called The Common Mind, that situation is explored more thoroughly. But for our purpose here, we offer the following. Oliver North is of the generation which had the first elements of the system applied to them in the public schools. He would have been in elementary school in the 50s, when radical concepts were rapidly replacing tried and true teaching methods. Indoctrination was replacing education. And to what purpose? In later grades in school, there were quote-unquote sociodramas, group dynamics, and other psychological tools to condition future citizens to accept directed reaction to any given situation. All through the years in public school, there were the ubiquitous, quote, cumulative files, or cum files, end quote, which chronicled the conduct of the student sequentially, allowing tracking of his or her reaction to the school experience, as well as academic progress or lack thereof. Then, in high school, the counselor became a fixture. Counselors could channel the student into future occupation by reviewing the, quote, cum file, end quote. But in addition to the record of academic progress, there was also that record of how cooperative or otherwise a student was. those who were more cooperative, more susceptible to control, could be channeled into occupations where they could best serve the cause of the establishment. Those who demonstrated strong personal conviction or rebellion to authority could be handled in other ways. Throughout the school years, American history and government were downplayed. Disinformation and misinformation were introduced into texts. Tried and true values were replaced with a new morality. The continuity of our socio-political heritage became disjointed by redirecting the way these future citizens would view the world and its problems. It has been said that, quote, in politics, nothing ever just happens. If it happens, it is because it was planned that way, end quote. She doesn't say so. Maureen doesn't say so, but that was FDR who said that. Isn't it simply too much of a coincidence that all these things which were being introduced into the schools in the 50s just happen to fit as preparations for introduction of the system in its total implementation? As they might apply to Oliver North, consider again his appearance before Congress as a career officer serving in the office of the president. All his adult life was spent in the military, where the system had been perfected. Did his high school record show him to be a likely candidate for service to a higher cause than run-of-the-mill graduates? There have been numerous accounts of experiments performed on service personnel without their knowledge or consent. Documented examples of these experiments vie with each other for their callous disregard of the consequences suffered by the victims, or, indeed, their rights under the Constitution to be secure in their persons. Most widely known of these experiments was probably the deliberate testing of nuclear fallout on unsuspecting GIs in the Nevada desert. Is it too far from reality to suggest that the need for subjects on which to test the effectiveness of systematic control had a limitless supply in the military where it was developed? Was Oliver North programmed for what he was doing in the NSC? We may never know for sure. What we do know is that Oliver North publicly admitted to performing acts which were not in character for anyone with his background, stated beliefs, and intelligence, and he testified to those acts with a conviction which gave them a validity they did not warrant. What we must know is that cybernetics as a conditioning agent is a clear and present danger to national security in the context of our lawful government, as well as a Damoclean sword over the head of each and every citizen who can be used to further the schemes of the Matoids who were able to penetrate the most sensitive redoubt in our security armor, our armed forces. Oliver North may indeed be the hole in the dike which can become the flood of resistance to post-constitutional America so dreaded by the elitists. I'm not sure about that last sentence by Maureen Heaton. I'm not even sure of her meaning. Anyway, okay, folks, those were chapters 31 through 34 of the late Maureen Heaton's manuscript, The Impossible Dream. You've been listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Gordon Comstock. The website is GordonComstock.com. If I told you now, if I told you now, if I told you now, how it would end, if I told you now.
leave our children here. If I told you now, this
world is not my home. This world is not my home. This world is not my home. Pass through. This world is not my home. This world is not my home. This world is not my home. I'm just passing through. I can't live at home in this world anymore. I can't live at home in this world. At home in this world anymore. I can't live at home in this world anymore.
This world where my children, this world where my children, this world where my children have gone before. This world where my children, this world where my children, this world where my children have gone before. I can't live at home in this world anymore. I can't live at home in this world.
That is the way things are.